Don't forget to turn on the microphone.
I think there's one more thing. I mean, maybe started touching on it.
Mm-hmm.
Becky has talked about it. We get kind of tunnel vision.
Mm-hmm.
Those in larger metropolitan areas, they see air pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And we can tie something to air pollution.
Right.
So they naturally go to that conclusion
mm-hmm.
that this other stuff is tied to it.
Right.
Their tendency is to go there. We're in a more rural, mm-hmm. open, clean air.
Yeah.
So our natural inclination is to totally go the mm-hmm. opposite way.
And I think it's this part. Like, I was thinking through, like, is there anything, when I read the climate change, and let's go as far as into it as possible, what are the conclusions, the climate change conclusions, that I have to reject because of the scriptures? Because there's a lot of times I think that we reject things just, that's too crazy, right? But there may not be anything scripturally that would cause me, like, is there anything scripturally that says man is not going to increase or cause an increase in the global temperature, right? So we can't just reject it because, oh, that sounds crazy, right? So what do you guys think? Scripturally, think about the conclusions that, you know, some of those severe, what are some things that we can reject based on scripture in terms of what should we do about global warming, or how big of an issue is global warming or climate change? Is there anything that you can say for sure, I know scripturally that this is not a valid?
Well, first off, the world won't be judged by water.
Yes, can you give me, there's a good reference to that.
Noah's flood.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, if you guys want to look there, I can just reference it. Genesis 8, 21 and 22. Genesis 8, 1, 21 and 22. So if you think about a climate change saying, basically, if we don't stop this, the entire world will be flooded and all life will die, right? So what do we see in Genesis 8? Someone read Genesis 8, 21 and 22. I think that's where it was. Yeah.
And the Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil. From his youth I will never again destroy every living thing that I've done. While the earth remains, seed time, harvest time, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. That's not where he said it didn't flood.
All right, and then before when the... Where else does he say? There's the part where he gives the rainbow. I can't remember where that was.
I think that's 9:9.
9:9.
Okay. God, behold, I will establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth, with you as many as come out of the ark. It is for every beast of the earth that will establish my covenant with you, that never again shall all flesh be cut off by waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth.
There you go. So we have a little bit of clarity in terms of that sense.
And that would be like a global flood. And
right.
With global warming.
They're not really...
If water goes a mile inland,
mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily...
Right.
We're not guaranteed that would not happen.
Correct. Correct. And we're not guaranteed that there won't be floods. We're not guaranteed that there won't be floods that kill lots of people. So again, we kind of have to be careful in terms of what does the Bible say. The boundaries are pretty extreme in terms of what we can allow and that might theoretically happen. I think this other question, question C, is a pretty interesting one. Is global warming a good or a bad thing, right? So there's in the survey, to what degree do you think that climate change might have some positive effects for some societies? Notice that it says it might, there's a might, some positive effects, some societies, right? So you got these three things. It's not saying that it will. It's not saying it's for everyone. And it says most scientists, almost 70%, expressed some degree of support. Only 70% gave it little or no support. Nearly nine times as many scientists had a great degree of confidence that benefits would result. Right? So what they're saying is that some people might benefit from the climate being warmer.
One of the arguments is the Earth is already, because of the little bit of warming that we have,
mm-hmm.
the Earth is already, and the increased carbon dioxide, the Earth is greener than it had been in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's you know, a lot of the discussion is around the carbon dioxide and those gases, and so it would be, it seems, I don't know what the word I'm looking for. We don't want to just say that, oh, those are bad gases, right? Because they're useful for all the plant life.
Yeah. I mean, carbon dioxide is not like sulfur dioxide.
Right.
That makes
it's not
like
poisonous.
The rain acidic. It's not a poison. It's life-giving. If you're a plant, you love it.
Mm-hmm.
Necessary.
Yeah. And I think oftentimes we...
It'd be like saying oxygen's a pollutant.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That'd be the rough equivalent. You know?
It can be. I mean, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, and I think that's what they talk about with global warming is it's not that the gas is, it's the effect it has as an insulator,
mm-hmm.
right, in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. It in and of itself is not a bad...
Yeah. And so I guess the question again is, I think it's easy to get sidetracked on trying to make scientific interpretations and come to conclusions, which is not really our field and our topic right here. Like, what we're really trying to do is think about the implications of what the scientific community is saying, what recommendations they're making. So is there anything we can do about it? And of those choices, what's the kind of the ethical considerations that we should make? Because, you know, if you happen to go into climate science or something like that, then these questions would be more pertinent. But as for us as general Christians and believers, we're mainly concerned with what impact or what choices can we make or should we make that are related to that. So here's an interesting statistic and paragraph. Look at this. So they have this Kyoto Protocol, which has to do with emissions, right? And its target for the United States, right? If the United States were to adhere to that and reduce its emissions, it would hurt the economy by approximately $300 billion is the forecast. About 3.5% of the gross domestic product in 98. So cutting the domestic product by $300 billion would have an impact on many people's lives, right? There's risk assessment estimate. And again, just the same way that we might criticize computer models, right? These are rough numbers. So we're trying to talk about the principle, although we could maybe disagree on the amount. Estimate that every $5 to $10 million drop in economic output results in one additional statistical death per year. Whew, that's complicated, right? So you drop the national GDP by $5 to $10 million, one more person is going to die as a result of that lack of economic production. That's a tough prediction to make, I would think.
I'd like to see that formula.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. Basically,
suicides, despair, just increases of poverty.
So it's kind of a tracing those things down. And so maybe it results, maybe it's
10 people. We don't know. Yeah.
We don't know. Could be more, could be less. But the basic idea is true that, right, the fewer resources, the less money, the less food, the less shelter, the less clothing. Mm-hmm. Statistically, it's more likely that more people will die.
Yeah.
And so, again, quantifying those amounts is very, very difficult. And so, like, here's a, you know, if we do cut down our economy by $300 billion, we're estimating 19,000 to 30,000 more deaths statistically in the country.
That's worldwide.
I think this is just in the United States.
Yeah, just the United States.
So,
in a less developed country could be even worse.
Most likely it would be worse. So for us, 30,000, let's say it's the max of 30,000 out of 300 million. It's like 1 out of 100,000, mm-hmm. right? So just kind of trying to think about the context there. So we have...
1/10 of 1%.
Yeah. Small amount in one sense, but 30,000 people in the other. And these kind of quantifying numbers, it is an ethical question because the same, we're talking about the same thing now when people evaluate the number of deaths from coronavirus, right? What is a significant amount, right? So ethically, you have to decide, you know, how much change is worth saving how many lives? There's an ethical question there. So would it be worth it, right? The estimates say, if the whole world reduced their emissions by the standards and cut them 7% below what they were in 1990, then when we get to 2047, about 30 more years, we might be able to cut 0.19 degrees Celsius of the warming instead of a half a degree Celsius. We'll only go up like 3/10 of a degree Celsius. And so it does bring into this idea of the amount of change that's necessary and the effect that it brings. And so it's a question we bring up, I think, in almost every profession, in education. I talk to my colleagues a lot about, okay, we can make a difference here, but is the amount of change that we're putting in worth the difference we're making? Cost benefit. Yeah, so everybody needs to know.
The pandemic's a great illustration of this.
Huge.
It's just what cost are we willing to pay to save?
Theoretically. A guaranteed cost versus to gain a theoretical.
Yeah.
But you can't get people to wear a mask, so you're not going to get people to stop driving their car or painting their house or whatever it is that causes. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just not going to happen, so they probably should just go ahead and plan for the worst and stop planning for how to stop it.
Mm-hmm. And it is interesting on like what you can... Yeah, what you can change in human behavior, right? And so there's the group that says, well, we can change, we regulate it, right, government? And that makes some difference for some people. In other words, seatbelt laws probably cause more people to wear their seatbelts than if it were not required, but it doesn't make everyone wear their seatbelts, right? It makes some difference.
Yeah.
So a lot of cloudy stuff here. And I think one thing to take away is that we need to be careful to take a hard line on a lot of these issues. I think it's really nuanced, and to go into a particular policy issue, whether it's related to energy or agriculture, there's a ton of things to consider. And so I think as Christians, we want to be careful not to get kind of in that polarized, I'm for this or I'm against this. Like, be careful and just approach each scenario. Let's see. Anything else I want to hit on here? I think maybe just a little bit more, just kind of to hit home, like what we've mentioned a couple times, that kind of towards the bottom of page 12, there's a little comment there. Thirdly, the people who global warming advocates most want to save will be the most affected by this or these changes. Okay? So oftentimes, right, this is the Cornwall Alliance, right? Reducing energy consumption will require significantly increasing costs of energy or medicine or cars or, right? It raises the cost through taxation or supply restriction or required technology or research or etc. It comes at a great cost, which will require basically spread through the entire economy, right? Because it's all interconnected. So for wealthy people, this might require some adjustments, inconvenient or disappointing, but for the world's 2 billion or more people who can barely afford food and clothing or shelter, and are without electricity, refrigeration, cooking, light, heat, and air conditioning, it could be a life and death, right? So if the cost for everything goes up a certain amount, most people who are above the poverty line will be able to absorb that cost. But there's a large number, billions, that are just barely on the razor's edge surviving.
And I think you even look at development. If you have a coal-rich country that's told that they can't burn coal, all of that economic development is not afforded to them. You know, and those are lives that could have been saved but are held back. So you can't necessarily measure a reduction of life, but... If you look at air conditioning, how many lives are saved by air conditioning?
Right. And how many are lost when they, that's always they put on the news and there's no power and there's a heat wave and people are found.
Could have had abundant energy and wealth to have air conditioning. That would save a bunch of lives, too.
And I think too, it's interesting that we, you know, the talk about how we treat the environment and how it might save lives, also with like how we've dealt with the pandemic and the coronavirus is saving lives. I think there's a balance there too, because we have to realize that we can, there's a lot of ways we can prolong life, right? We never save anyone's life, but we can prolong life so they can die from something else. Right? You can't save anyone.
You have to stop heart disease. So cancer can be number one.
Right. They're all just replacing one another as the top cause of death. So it is, I mean, in a sense, we want to save life in the sense that we're eliminating as many causes of death as we can. But in general, right, we're just prolonging it.
We're just managing.
Shifting things around. I thought this was a good thought question. How can fighting poverty help the poor countries adapt to the negative impact of global warming? Like, for example, you're saying talking about how those poor countries, so if you want to reduce emissions, you know, maybe you could focus on countries that can afford to, or develop countries that can, you know, having a viewpoint that considers trying to reduce greenhouse gases if that's scientifically supported, but doing it in such a way that considers humans that are unable to make that sacrifice, who are in the first rung of development. So maybe not always kind of just having a single...
Depends what you mean by fighting poverty. What's the definition of that?
Right. So. Or how do you fight poverty, right? Because we have different...
How do you effectively fight
poverty? Right. Is that giving things? Is that teaching? Is that
eating
building
everything.
A business? What's that?
Clean up your plate.
Eating everything on your plate.
There you...
Sorry.
Starving
Sorry.
People. People are starving.
The school cook here kind of...
Sorry, got a lot of grandkids.
Yep.
I think when you talk about fighting poverty, I think it just shows that this is a way more complex issue. There's a lot of consequences that a lot of these policy changes that are being advocated, they do have a cost, and you just have to measure, you know, how great is the benefit. How great is the cost? So, I mean, a lot of it is... I mean, there's really no Christian perspective on...
Right. Right.
But I think you can have a Christian perspective either way. Like, you can be pro-poverty relief and pro-economic development. And even pro-capitalism as a way of lifting people out of poverty. And people kind of forget that capitalism is the time and... You know, the tried and true way of doing so. If you look at India, for instance, I mean, there is a genuine middle class in India where hundreds of millions of people have been lifted out of poverty and they have enough to eat, they can afford air conditioning, medical care. Now, there's still a lot of abject poverty in India, but there's way less than there used to be. And I even think instances of, you know, as you said, Sean, I mean, no one's going to do all this stuff. Well, in the Soviet Union, they knew that and they made sure it happened. And often these forced impositions of social change and to save to save the world, there's always the temptation of totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. And
a benevolent dictator.
Benevolent dictator who kills.
Well, just give power
a mostly benevolent dictator. Yeah. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah. This has been really good for me because sometimes we have these like in our Christian ethics topics, and it's like this is the Christian view. And really, a lot of the, when you consider the environment, there's kind of the principles that we learned that God created us to care for the earth and to be his image bearers and to bring it under subjugation. But how we do that the best, there's differing biblically acceptable ways. But in terms of its implications, you got to consider how does it impact not only the earth, but kind of your fellow man. We don't take care, this is in the conclusion, we don't take care of the earth because we worship it, but because we love God and our fellow man. God made a planet that was meant to be used. He called us to populate it, cultivate it, so that we'll reach a greater potential of sustaining life and giving glory to him. So, yeah, there's still lots of questions in terms of what can we do with technology to adapt, you know, to whatever is the change, regardless of what that change really is.
I think one thing that makes it kind of hard is Christians, we kind of have a cynicism towards scientists.
Yeah.
Because we're young earth creationists, and what does science know? So we just kind of have this natural cynicism towards scientists, which clouds the issue. Mm-hmm. We know scientists are saying this.
Right.
But implicitly,
we
don't trust that thing.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times,
and I'm not sure if that's good or bad. You know what I'm saying?
Right. And a lot of times, what I've found is trying to take into account what I know many times the assumptions are, and say, if I had those same assumptions, would I reach any different conclusions from the data? Like a lot of times, this part and this part are done really well, but I disagree with where their starting point is, what their basic assumptions are about how to interpret that, and that's why they reach different conclusions. And so what I think what can be helpful is just try and read through and see what is it they're actually observing, and then allow your biblical worldview to allow you to interpret those observations. And then you can reach a biblical conclusion a lot of times. So we know, and we have a Genesis account of where the world came from, and we can look at the observations and ask ourselves, well, how do those observations fit in with the biblical worldview? And then maybe come to different conclusions. This gets applied a lot when we talk at home, like about evolution, right? What's evolution mean, and like that broad term, and so.
Yeah, I think a couple principles to extract is it is important to protect human life because we are image bearers. Protecting Mother Earth isn't our priority; it's protecting human life, and then also seeing humans as the protector of Mother Earth and understanding that. You know, there's an ingenuity being made in the image of God to address some of these issues. Mm-hmm. Like, now we have a bunch of windmills. And maybe, I mean, I haven't seen my electrical, anybody seen your electrical bill go down?
Right.
Hasn't happened yet. You got to pay for those windmills off, and then we'll get free energy.
Right, right.
It's a turnpike.
Yeah, that's right. Just like the turnpike. And sales tax. It will go down eventually. Yeah. Sorry, don't get me started.
Don't get him started.
Yeah, so there is a, human life is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for the earth, and protecting human life is a worthwhile cause. Yeah. So, think any policy that will have, if global warming will truly take away human life, then we should be against it because we want to save human life.
Right. And we also talked about, I think that was one thing that's helpful is that we know that the world in its current state is intentionally and subjected to the curse. And so we're not in that pre-fall state. Like, God did curse the ground. He did curse the earth. And we know that it's kind of that groaning under those birth pangs waiting till its redemption. And so we can have a different kind of end goal, right? We don't really see this perfect harmonious relationship between man and the animal kingdom and the earth, because we know that until Christ redeems man, we're going to still, like what you're saying, there's still going to be people that just abuse and pollute and destroy and do all these things. Well, we'll have a much lighter, lighthearted topic next week, right?
Yeah.
Capital punishment.